interest is how cells interact with three-dimensional extracellular matrices. And a lot of my focus over my career has been, it's been on how to make a tube, how to make a cell line tube. There's been a lot of, and what's neat is that a lot of the models that we've developed, and so we're basically modelers in our own right using cells and culture models to model in vivo events. So what we've tried to do over the years is develop models to create three-dimensional networks of tubes, and then we've tried to now expand them to not only form to study that, but also to look at how you stabilize a tube network and also how you also regress tube networks. Thank you very much. So there's been a lot of discussion at the meeting about tumor invasion, so I thought I would... We also are interested, as everyone else is, in tumor invasion. A lot of our techniques we've worked on over the years have been very helpful to study this, so I'm just going to just spin off just for a few minutes to tell you a little bit about what we've done with this, which is related to the endothelial field. Over the past, 7-8 years, there's a new class of molecules that is very powerful and called these lipids that are called lysophosphatidic acid or sphingosine 1-phosphate. And for actually a lot of work in our lab, as well as others, have now really implicated that these are key molecules that regulate cellular invasive behavior. And this is, I believe, the reason I mention it in this context is that it's really a general phenomenon. And either one of these lipids, depending on the cell type, can really dramatically drive invasion of three-dimensional matrices. And these are neat molecules in that they bind to a class of 7-pass receptors that are linked to G proteins, in many cases a G protein called G-alpha-I, that's sensitive to pertussis toxin, and which is really kind of a neat way to test whether something has involved G-alpha-I. But in any case, they bind, and this creates a variety of signals which activates signaling pathways as well as the cytoskeleton and drives cell behavior. So one of the things that we've been tried to develop is a tumor invasion model. And so what I'm going to show you is work from a MD-PhD student of my lab, Kevin Fisher, who has used a very known to be highly invasive cell line called HT1080 fibrosarcoma cells. And using our three-dimensional systems, and we've figured out a way of visualizing these from the side. So this is the monolayer of the gel. The cells are seated on the surface, and using control, so what we do is we incorporate these lipids actually into the gel. So mix them into the collagen, and that may turn out to be important. So control is like this. If you use a very high density of collagen, our typical dose, 3.75 mg per mil, you can see that over a couple of days, there's little invasion past the monolayer. In contrast, when you add things like lysophosphatidic acid, there's a lot of cells that have invaded. And a related lipid, S1P, can do the same thing with the cell line, and if you combine them, the same kind of a deal. So you basically are able to then assay the invasion of the cells in that way, through almost like looking at them horizontally. Now, one of the things that's neat is we've spent, like Charlie Little has done over many years, we've actually developed models to make movies of this process. So here is, again, looking at the side, and these are LPA-induced HT1080s that are invading in a collagen matrix. And so this actually invasion, that this front that's occurring with these cells are moving very fast, and actually the invasion front from the start to the finish here ends up being about 0.7 millimeters of distance. So this is a really dramatic invasion response. And so this is what these cells do. They invade as single cells predominantly. You'll see often cells kind of follow other cells. You see divisions here. That was a division right there. So there's a lot of tremendous cell movement, and this whole front is moving dramatically. Now, one of the issues that's been discussed at the meeting is, do you need proteases for this event?
So, George, what's the time frame on that?
48 hours, 2 days. Yes, very much so. Many tumor cells are not particularly invasive. This particular cell line is highly invasive.
What about concentration within them? If you put less cells in there, would that be less per line?
Fewer cells would give you less. less invasion. Now, so one experiment then to determine if this is protease dependent is to add a protease inhibitor, and so we've done that. One of the things that's really interesting is at the front, you can see there's tremendous cell movement going on in the monolayer, and you'll note that there are all these little processes that come out, and if we watch this over time, actually some of them are going to break off and actually wander off without the cell, which you can see. But so they're able to send out these very thin little filopodia-like processes, but note that none of this invasion is occurring. So this at 3.75 mg per mil gel, so if you watch right here, there's like a little snake that's appearing. There's a process that literally breaks off from the monolayer. If you look around, there it is. It's taking off and migrating within the gel without the cell. So actually, you know, these little thin processes are really able to move in the presence of inhibition of protease inhibitors, which is really kind of surprising, but the rest of the cell can't move. And that's something of great interest to us. So we're interested then, you know, in using this kind of system. And the goal here is to understand what molecules are required and what signaling pathways are required here.
They don't move all those processes, don't move all the way across.
No, they don't. They run out of energy. So you can. What's kind of neat, though, and it's you guys being mathematicians, and certainly we're not, but this is a quantifiable system. So, you know, because we can do time lapse, we can measure invasion fronts over time, and note that with the protease inhibitor, again, there is essentially no invasion. And LPA has an enormous effect, and you can plot that over time and get essentially a rate of invasion of a population of cells. You can also, of course, which we haven't done yet, but we wish to do, is look at individual invading cells, which we are doing using nuclear label cells. And so you could literally image the entire population. Other point I want to make before I ask your question is that there is no gradient of LPA here. This is a constant amount of LPA placed in a gel, and they're still doing this, and they're still moving as a front.
Well, can they create their own gradient?
Well, they could do something locally, but I'm saying is that it's a constant amount of LPA.
Right.
And so it may be that the LPA is not available.
Did they degrade LPA?
I think they can do that. They actually probably can.
They could be making a protease gradient at their
own. Well, this invasion is completely protease dependent, as I said. I mean, if you block the protease, I actually know which protease. This is MT1 MMP. So if you knock this, if you do the same experiment, knock the gene down, you get essentially no invasion.
And if you transfect with a constitutively active version of the...
We don't have such a construct, but if you take a cell that does not have MT1 MMP and transfect MT1 MMP, they begin to invade. But it's complicated. There's probably a lot of different components to this.
Yeah, just a physical chemical question rather than biological.
Sure.
What concentration is the LPA at?
This is 1 micromolar, which is a physiologic concentration of LPA in plasma.
Yeah, again, I don't care about the biology.
Yeah.
I'm interested more in the CMC or the solubility of the LPA. It's a charged molecule.
Yeah, it is.
Negative charged molecules.
Yeah.
So it's it's ionic interaction with a positively charged species. It's a very we've done experiments on cell large lipid vessels with PC.
Yeah.
And they have a solubility, so they can actually transfer into membranes and they'll get in the outer monolayer.
Yeah.
So all your cells will have this detergent in the outer monolayer of their membrane.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a physical chemical thing going on, which then becomes biology.
Yeah. I just think it's intriguing that we can, you know, I grant you that the cells can potentially create through but the actual molecule which is driving the pathway is not applied in the gradient. So the cells it may be that the molecule that's given in the matrix is actually in a state which is non-functional, and that the cells, by degrading collagen, which they do, liberate the molecule and create the gradient in front of them as I go. That's my vote.
But it's a deterrent. And so the question would be, would other negatively charged detergent do the same thing?
No, I don't. Well, in the case of endothelial cells, which I'll show, I'm not going to present you any data with LPA, but with endos. But S1P is the only one that works with endothelial cells. they invade with S1P and not LPA. So that sort of answers your question in a way. This is totally pertussis toxin sensitive. This is G-alpha I mediated. If you block pertussis, they don't invade. So this is a real pathway of invasion. It's not a simple...
Just trying to eliminate this kind of physical chemistry.
Yeah. No, I don't think that that's the... Sorry.
Sure.
Yeah.
I just wondering if you ever tried lower collagen concentrations?
They go faster.
Is the MMPs, are they equally important in the lower?
That's a good question. They are important, but as you diminish the density of collagen, sort of by definition, then they probably become less important. But so it's very, I mean, in vivo, this is a low, collagen is higher than this in vivo in an adult animal. So therefore, we're, if anything, undershooting. So when people use 1 mg/mL collagen gels, I would be skeptical of that.
And they're also more highly cross-linked.
Yeah, they're much more highly cross-linked. It's absolutely right. So another thing we've done, just to kind of make this point, is we've used nuclear-labeled HTs, put them in the gel, and watched them wander around. I don't have time to present the movie, but using metamorph programs and so on, they're moving around. If you add the proteinase inhibitor or you knock down MT1MMP with SI, they don't move around. So this, again, I showed you from the invading from a front going in, or if you suspend the cells within the gel and do this, LPA drives this. So we think LPA drives the... activation probably, or presentation of the proteinase, and integrates the integrin interactions, and somehow this coordinates the lead to this directed invasive response. So that's really and our real goals here to try to understand molecularly what is really required. And we've made, I think, good progress on this already. So now the real why I was invited was to talk about our work on blood vessel formation. And really, as I mentioned, my interest is in how to make a cell line tube. I also would like to how to mature that tube. I'd like to figure out ways to get that tube to be coated by supporting cells such as pericytes. And then I'm very interested in this phase, which has not been that well studied over the years, but has high relevance, particularly in cancer biology, where you want to regress vascular networks that supply tumors. And so what we really want to know then is, what is the molecular basis of how do you create a cell line tube network, how do you mature a tube, and how do you regress tubes? And I think the argument I would make is that with the right in vitro model, I think a lot of these questions are now really answerable. I mean, I think we have the technology now to get at these kind of questions. I think this, as you'll see, I think some of this stuff, really can be done in vitro systems. Okay. So here's an example. You talked about the LPA. Here's endothelial cells invading, just to kind of analogize with the tumor. There's a monolayer that's out of focus. I'm focused underneath it to start seeing the sprouts as they start invading. And note they're not invading everywhere. They're invading in kind of spatial ways. And so it's not really clear, why that is. But so you can really easily image this. And the other point that I think is important is that as they're invading in response to things like sphingosine 1-phosphate, the other thing that endothelial cells do that's unique, that's much different than what you saw with the tumor cells, is that these cells make a lumen. And that's a very important-ish difference. And, one of the things I'm really keenly interested in is, what is the mechanism of lumen formation? Yeah. Sure, they migrate. Invasion is the ability to move into a three-dimensional matrix. And as I'll show later with these cells, the proteases do not, if you block the proteinases, it does not affect their motility on a dish. It only affects their ability to invade into the three-dimensional environment that we've seen. So there's a distinction there. So one of the points I wanted to make, at higher power, again, invading, here's a nice endothelial cell, a single cell that's invading by, and you can kind of see its morphology. If you follow here, in particular, this is a pretty neat little area. You can see there are lots of little vesicles moving around, but this one is kind of neat. You can start seeing a lumen develop, and it just basically trails all the way down and ends up forming a very impressive luminal structure. So this is well beneath the monolayer. So when these cells invade, they truly make a very distinct and obvious luminal compartment. So somehow the invasion process with endothelial cells, and of course epithelial cells also make tubes, leads to lumen development. And so a lot of our interest
is... Is that a multicellular sprout?
Oh, yes. Yeah, this is definitely has multiple cells.
So you did show that single cell. So what sort of your percentage of sprouting invasion versus single cell invasion?
Well, I would say the majority of the cells, it depends on how you do the experiment. With sphingosine 1-phosphate, I'd say maybe a third are single. And actually, what I think happens is that it's actually really cool what they do, I think, is that they send in cells that are connected to tube trunks. They also send in individual ones, which I think are then undergo like a little mini vasculogenic event. They form a lumen and spread laterally. So I think it helps networking if a percentage of the cells invade and are not connected with the trunks that are going down, but they are sort of sent out in space, and then they hook up and connect this way. So that's what I think they do.
Could you possibly sketch on the blackboard? I mean, I can see there's a lumen forming here, but if I section that,
oh yeah, it's
how many cells is that? One cell that's curling around?
Yeah. Well, there are, I'd say in this, I'm going to guess that this structure right here has about 4 to 5 cells.
Lengthwise,
it's extraordinary.
Lengthwise, but radially.
Well, a single cell certainly can make a lumen that size. I mean, I don't know what the actual. This is probably like around a 25 micron or something like that. I'm going to guess luminal diameter. But yeah, no, they can. This is the actual three dimensional reconstruction is one of the real challenges here to be able to do this kind of movies. And then do that. And that's one of the things we really want to be able to do. And that's what Vicky was doing, trying to do. You know, we all want to be able to do that, to try to line up how these things all hook together. But it's extraordinary how many, you don't need as many cells as you think. I mean, these cells are extraordinary.
But I should be thinking of that as a single cell.
Oh, no, this is a multicellular structure.
Not in length, but in diameter.
Yeah,
if I took a cut through.
Yeah, you might see there's a nucleus. You see one nucleus.
A crescent shape. Structure.
Yeah,
and the question
true.
Is how many cells are around the periphery?
Generally, I would say, you know, well, here, this to me looks like a nucleus. If you cut across here, you may see two. But it depends on where you cut, but not in every case. I'd say in either one or two maximum.
So a single cell can make a complete.
Oh, yes, cell. Absolutely.
And that is in natural blood vessels as well. That's
yeah,
we
you bet. Well, no, okay, so the mechanism of, let me get into this in a little more detail. So the biggest model we study in our system is what we call our vasculogenic mimic, which is the cells are single cells suspended in 3D collagen, 3D space, and then they interconnect to form these networks within 2 days. And what's really neat is that the mechanism of lumen formation in this model is through an intracellular process. So we've been studying this now for a long time. This is an intracellular lumen formation event which occurs in these cells, and then as they're doing that, they begin to interconnect and hook up with their neighbors to form these structures. So yes, an individual cell can make a lumen. They begin to do this, and then they start sprouting toward each other. And I think sequentially, you know, it doesn't so much matter. There, in some cases, endothelial cells clearly can make cords first and then make a lumen. I really don't think it matters which direction it is. I think it occurs in both directions. And I think that, and ultimately, the purpose of this is to create a space within the matrix which these cells can occupy to create the lumen. And it doesn't really matter to me anymore which way they go, but vacuoles definitely play a major role in this event. And if you do things like EM, you know, you can really see how dramatic these things really are. This is after probably about 8 hours, and this is a probably 24-hour time point. So you can see they form. It turns out that these are integrin-dependent. If I block the integrin, the integrin that controls this is alpha 2 beta 1 and collagen receptor. If you block that, these don't form at all. They swell, they fuse, and eventually form the lumen, and there's the matrix, and it's a matrix-free space. And this involves RhoGTPases, and we showed a number of years ago that CDC 42 is required. So is, we think, RAC1, although this would seem to be the most dominant at the time. So this is a neat system. This requires integrin contacts with collagen signaling through RhoGTPases to form these. These are also pinosomes. They are derived from pinocytic events. If we add fluorescent tracers in the dye, these label. So these are actually, you know, pinocytic vesicles which fuse and eventually create this space.
There's some change in size, is that right?
The cell, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, I think the cells definitely enlarge. I think we have in our system, we haven't done a lot with this, I think they probably do get larger in this process. But this is a work in progress. We're trying to figure out how this happens. Now, one of the more exciting things in this project has been a collaboration that my lab is working with Brant Weinstein at the NIH, who's one of the world leaders in zebrafish vascular development. And using some vectors that we created that are fusion proteins, carrying green fluorescent protein to CDC42, Makoto Kaime and Brant created transgenic zebrafish, which actually then, it turns out we can, and we've published this, that you can label the vacuoles with this structure, and that creating these fish, what they're able to show, we have, this paper is going to be coming out in the next few months, and are working together on this, is that you can see vesicles and vacuoles fusing during zebrafish vascular development. And not only that, if you supply tracers into the lumen of the large vessels in these intersegmental sprouts, you can see that these fill as if they are, again, pinocytic-like structures. So if you really look carefully, you can see like trains of vacuoles that form through the cell. And we think that at least early on, when there's, say, two or three cells stacked together, that they actually core out in the center of the cell and line up like this, and with vacuoles running in that axis. And so we think, and if you look, there's here are endothelial cells, human ECs doing the same thing. So we really do believe that this is a key mechanism to create liminal structures in an in vivo model. And over the years, many investigators have seen vacuoles in vivo in development and angiogenesis and so on. So we do think that this is at least an important mechanism in this process. So to visualize our vasculogenic system in more detail, we do movies like this, where cells are just vacuolating like crazy and interconnecting. So you can see that the lumen process is occurring dramatically, and at the same time, they're interconnecting in this plane. And what's neat about the system now is that because we can manipulate and go after individual genes, you're able to then figure out which genes are required to form from this single cell population to now this interconnecting network of tubes.
What do you know about the signaling that's involved in the fusion of
the vesicles
between cells?
Not between cells. Not a lot.
Lumen is basically completely surrounded by the cells. So when you have your cells come into contact with each other, they now have to.
Yeah, we believe these are exocytic events.
Okay.
I think it's an exocytosis pathway. In terms of knowing exactly what's going on, I would say, don't know, but my guess is that some of the exocytotic machinery that is known is probably involved. We're working on that. It's an important question.
What's the reason of this speculation?
It's an integrin dependent. The process that's probably most related to it is macropinocytosis, which is a RhoGTPase integrin-dependent uptake of fluid that's been described in macrophages and other cells. And I think they've kind of co-opted this personally to create this structure. It's a very efficient way to create a luminal space in a 3D environment. If you wrapped around the collagen, you would end up having a bunch of collagen in the middle, which you'd have to digest. What I think they do is they create this structure. And actually, what I'm going to show you here is that they actually proteolyze around. So in order for this to happen, they have to be proteasely, using a protease called MT1MMP, to cut on the surface to expand. So they have to create space, and this is occurring simultaneously as they're vacuolating and forming these structures.
I would bet you that they not only have to create the space in order to do that, but once the space is created, the cell membrane wants to bind to the collagen wall, and that stretches the cell.
I think that happens. Yeah, that's true.
So when one vesicle just forms, what's inside?
It's fluid.
Plasmid?
Well, it's fluid from the media. But the other thing I should point out, our model is serum-free. So much like the I was trained in neurobiology, so I had the same basic setup. So we do like a insulin transfer and type base media and add our growth factor. So it's defined. So this all happens in a defined media.
So this is more like plant formation.
It's like what?
More like vessel formation in plants than probably any of us in the room who don't know this would expect.
Yeah, there's some similarities, and there is. So one of the things we've been trying to do is, you guys interested in, you know, quantitation, obviously, and so are we in this field. And so one of the approaches we've been taking using Metamorph software and tracing has been to take our movies and literally trace luminal areas. And so this is one of the approaches we've been taking. It is pretty tedious, but this is one example of this. And if one then quantitates lumen formation over time, where this is actually total luminal area micron squared, and it's kind of surprising to me, I guess, from my working for many years, is that about 70% or so of the lumen formation actually occurs within the first 24 hours in our system. And then it starts to level off at around 48, which is the time that we stopped this particular movie. But a lot of the morphogenic cascade, as I've just shown you, has actually been completed at 48. And of course, it continues to remodel as you go with time. And I'll discuss some of the protease stuff in a minute.
Is there some reason you can't, say, use optical deconvolution microscopy to get the 3D?
I just haven't done things like that. We've the past year and a half or so, really started doing this, and I think it's pretty effective what we've done. I mean, you know, we're able to quantitate this, we're able to use it as a way to characterize our system.
This is already beautiful. I just wondered if there was a technical problem because you're in a matrix that makes the optical.
It does make it more. It does make it more difficult. It is a little more difficult, but it's. I think it's doable. It's just something we haven't done yet.
I think Andras is going to do this.
Yeah.
Because it would do. You would oversample in Z, and then it would select the best focus point.
Yeah.
For you.
Yeah. We don't typically try. One thing we don't typically do is. We typically pick a random Z plane. We don't typically do Z stacks during this because it's so intensive on our computers and stuff.
And is this graph is for a spatial number of cells?
This is a field in which we've taken, you know, per defined area, we've measured the luminal area of that field, the total luminal area. And so, I mean, it's just a convenient way of assaying now quantitatively whatever the effect of the molecules of interest. So in this case, the TIMPs or the chemical inhibitor of MMPs, you know, there is no lumen formation whatsoever. And so this is a dramatic, dramatic effect. But if we look at whatever we want, whether it's a RhoGTPase or an integrin or whatever other molecule that you're interested in,
so
theoretically you can do this. I'm sorry.
TIMPs, do you have invasion at all?
No.
With
TIMP 2, 3, and 4, it's dramatically blocked.
So you have no invasion and no lumen.
That's right.
But these are separate assays. In one assay, you're putting the cells in the gel.
We do
and
both.
You're asking them to make a lumen, and the
yeah.
other one, you're...
That's true. Yeah, no, in order... Yeah, they don't make a lumen unless they enter the... Well, I mean, the surface is kind of a big lumen, I guess. But, but I mean, when they go in, you're right. They have to enter the gel in order to make it. So... Using a basic approach, you know, we've identified three molecules that we know are, I think we can say unequivocally, are involved and in required in our system. One is the integrin alpha 2 beta 1, the GTPase CDC42, and now the protease MT1. And I've already alluded to it. We think that the key events are these lumen formation and sprouting, and we think it can go back and forth, and that it can go in both directions to create multicellular networks. So one, I'll just show you a little bit of the data, things that I'm excited about for the future. So one of the technologies that we've really spent a lot of time in trying to perfect to be able to do the assays in our lab and to be able to then treat endothelial cells and then at the same time be able to do assays, which is challenging to do that, is to knock down genes using siRNA. And so we've become pretty good at it. The alpha-2 integrin subunit, which I've said is required using blocking antibodies, if you knock this gene down, dramatically by Western blot, you can see essentially that morphogenesis does not occur. So that's one very nice example. So in a sense, if you think about it, if you had an SI to every gene in the genome and you had a big enough lab and a bunch of people, you could literally, theoretically, screen every gene and try to do that kind of thing. There's a lot of complexities to this issue. The stability of the protein, how long it really takes to knock them down, what percentage of knockdown do you really need in order to see a functional effect? And that is variable, I think, based on our experience in some cases. But in this case, this is pretty clear. So this was very satisfying to me, knowing that we knew that we thought the syndrome was involved, and now it's blatantly involved. Juan Chilco in my lab, an MD-PhD student, has really doing a great work on CDC42. And so we knew that dominant negative CDC42, when introduced into endothelial cells, blocked lumen formation. But what was really neat is to knock down CDC42 using, again, an SI technique and compare it to RhoA, another RhoGTPase. And when you knock down CDC42, essentially lumen formation does not occur. And RhoA, there's no effect at all, which is really nice. And you can see the specificity of the knockdown with the individual proteins. And so what Wanschel's doing, and I don't have time to present this, is to go upstream and downstream of CDC42 and identify the critical molecules that are required to make these vascular networks and make vacuoles, lumens, and so on. So just to as a comparison, here is a movie in which case you've knocked down CDC42, and here are the cells, and note that they're not able to vacuolate. You do get occasional apoptotic cells, but a lot of them create this sort of half moon shape, and they just really kind of float around in their little lacunae, and they spin around and they don't do anything.
The cells that aren't in the gel look like they actually can still extend if they're not in the gel. Is that right?
Well, that one could be. Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know where that is. Whether that was on a surface and we're just underneath that, or whether that might be a cell. You know, some of our images are actually right up against the plastic,
yeah,
that's what you mean. And so that may be moving around. Yeah.
So it sort of rescues.
Yeah, it might rescue. That's a good point. But you're right. So, but the ones that are in the gel really are, you know, completely impaired.
So, George, it looks like that in addition to not making lumens, they also can't make interconnections. Right?
That's
because
correct
you,
in this
you
case.
You could imagine a situation where you could get a network, but that you just couldn't make the lumens.
That's true.
From the network.
I think that's possible. I mean, I do think that lumen formation is going to turn out to be a little more simplified. You know, a lot of this is about creating these spaces. The vacuole system allows you to create larger spaces, but all you need to do, I believe, is to create the space. And once you've done that, in a way, you can. So the vacuoles definitely enhance the ability to create these physical spaces that are occurring.
Distinguish between pathways that block the ability to interconnect and pathways that block the ability to form
I mean, in this case, you know, we're trying to look for things like that. I think you could. But what's kind of neat is that I think these are coupled. I mean, that, you know, they're doing this while they're looking for each other. I mean, they sense each other and through mechanics. And so I do think that this is simultaneously going on. Yet, could we get a situation where they could perfectly sprout but not interfere with lumen? I already know how to do that with a protease inhibitor. They sprout and they send processes out, but they don't, and they even kind of touch each other, but they don't form a lumen.
So what if you were magic? I know you're thinking along these lines since we talked last night, but if you were magic and you had one of your gels that used to have, that has a Swiss cheese.
Right.
You've taken magic, all the cells left their lacunae, left their
Right.
Now you put these cells in.
Yeah, that's a great question.
And
they might be fine.
It might be fine.
Yeah. Yes. 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 Alpha 1 is modestly blocked. It's definitely blocked to some extent. They do have alpha 1. Alpha 1 is induced in our arrays. The gene is there. And so our data agrees a lot with Don Senger's about alpha 2. In our system, it's predominantly alpha 2, but I think alpha 1 is doing something. Alpha 2 is the predominant receptor, but I think you definitely see some phenotypes with alpha 1 knockdown.
Another very naive question. What's happening to the microtubule network during lumen?
Well, we think microtubules are really critical to this. We think that, in fact, that microtubules are probably the predominant cytoskeletal form that's required for making a lumen. And the reason we published a paper a couple of years ago where we took existing networks and depolymerized the microtubules, and within minutes they collapsed completely. That's not true of actin. So we think actin's the fine-tuning, microtubules are the big shape changes. If you interfere with microtubules, they don't make vacuoles at all in the beginning. So we think that it's an integrated signal. The integrin more than likely is integrating the signaling between the microtubules and the actin. And I think that it has to go together.
But lumens form even if you block actin polymerization?
No.
No.
Vacuoles do not. You got to have actin.
Yeah,
but I'm just saying that the overall shape of a structure is more dependent on microtubules than it is actin.
That's what.
Yeah, I think it, yeah, we could. You could potentially use, labeled microtubule, plus n or minus n things. We've thought about that. We just haven't done that.
You know, just in general, if a organization lengthwise along the or the circumferential. What's the basic architecture of the microtubules?
That is a good question. We're interested in CDC42 because it one of the reasons we're interested in is that it's a polarity protein. And in fact, the vacuoles, which I can't show, but we know is that the vacuoles are recruited right around the center zone, and we think they're oriented. So I would argue that they know where they're putting their vacuoles and lumens. But in terms of being able to visualize this and be able to do things like that, I haven't done it yet. I mean, those are good. That's a good idea.
You've already done so much. You can't.
Yes. Okay. All right. So let me just present a little bit of the data on MMPs. We're very interested in MMPs because they are, very fundamental players in lots of processes, and lots of different ECM turnover, tissue regression, morphogenesis, inflammation, and of course invasive behavior. And there's a lot of these endothelial cells. I've indicated by arrows 4 genes that we know are induced in our model as they form. And what's really interesting, and just to throw out that I think is exciting, is that during the induction of morphogenesis in our system, there are MMPs that control formation. We think there are different MMPs that control regression. And I'll say something about it at the end, that I think that endothelial cells, when they form networks, are not just forming networks to form, they're also establishing the groundwork for their own demise and regression. And I believe that's part of, if you take a wound and wound repair called granulation tissue, it's well known that it forms and then regresses in stereotypical form. Same thing happens in the menstrual cycle. The tissue forms and regresses in a cyclical way. So we think that, and in development, I think there are more vessels born than are needed. My argument is that there's a program, genetic program, that's established to both form and regress, and that we think some other cell type more than likely is involved in protecting, which I'll allude to at the end. But some of the MMPs, we think, are probably critical in this decision point. So in terms of formation, we think that the major MMP are these the membrane type MMPs, and this was a nice review by Agnes Noel that I got this from, and MTMMP is a really neat molecule, MT1. It can do many things, and it's a cell surface and membrane protein. It can degrade the matrix. It can activate other proteinases, the most famous being MMP2. Interestingly, it's differentially inhibited by TIMP, so TIMP 2, 3, and 4 inhibit it, but TIMP 1 does not, and that's very interesting for a variety of reasons. This thing can not only cleave the matrix, it can also cleave varieties of receptors on the surface. It can cleave integrins, CD44, a hyaluronate receptor, proteoglycans like Syndican, which bind growth factors. It's one of the heparan sulfate proteoglycans. So this is a very fascinating molecule, linked to a lot of important molecules on the surface, and there's been recent studies by many very good labs who are implicating this molecule in their events. And so we, you know, the simple experiments that led us here is not complicated at all. So doing time-lapse movies, we've added recombinant TIMP1. This is Brian Saunders' work, a phenomenal postdoc in my lab. Recombinant TIMP1 does nothing. So here's a proteinase inhibitor that does not bind MT1 and MP. It blocks a variety of other proteinases such as MMP1, which I'll talk about at the end. It has no effect on formation. So they vacuolate, they form and form nice luminal networks. In contrast, TIMP3, you can see early on there are really no processes, but then they start forming processes. They try to interconnect, but note that there are no lumens. So here's an example of where they're sprouting to some extent, but they're not able to form a luminal space. So clearly, there's something special going on with the TIMP3 there. They're certainly there in terms of what they're doing. Don't know yet. Yeah, actually, that's even difficult when they are forming. I mean, they're, yeah, PCAMs, you know, VE-cadherin are there, but in terms of actually what they're doing and whether they're important, not clear. If you look at TIMP3 addition to in a movie here, you can see that in contrast to the other movies I showed you, these cells basically almost look like neurons, don't they? I mean, they look like they're sending out neurites. They're not making lumens, but they're trying to interconnect, and it's pretty neat looking, but they're clearly, their lumen is not able to form. So we actually think that this is beginning to make the argument that MT1-MMP is really a key regulator of lumen formation, which is a fundamental process. And so here it goes back to the quantitation again that I showed you earlier. So the controlled time course of quantitation using TIMP1, recombinant TIMP1, exactly the same time course, TIMP2, TIMP3, TIMP4, GM601 all block. And it's as simple as that. And we think MT1-MMP is probably the molecule. That would be it could be other MTs. It could be other potential players. Like there's MT2 and MT3. It could be one of those. So we wanted to figure that out. One of the approaches that we took was siRNA. So if you knock down a variety of metalloproteases on the cell surface, including members of the MT family as well as the ATOM family, another class of important surface proteinases, and we can show very nice knockdown, and here's actin controls of these genes, selective knockdown of them. And the one that really blocked was MT1 and siRNA. So here it is. Here's some vacuoles, some little nominal sprouting. It actually looks a lot like when you add TIMP3. They send out these little processes, but they can't make a lumen. Same exact results, essentially. If you quantitate this and look at a whole series of these, really only MT1 is the one that has a really substantial effect. We actually have some newer data that suggests that MT2-MMP may be doing something. So as we've gotten better at our SIs, we actually think that there's some areas where MT2 might be an accessory molecule, kind of like I said in some of the other comments, that this seems to be the predominant one. This one may be also a player. But we need to investigate this more. If you do time-lapse movies, here's series again. Here is knocking, luciferase that we use as a frequent control. They make the nice lumen structures over time. MMP1, which is a really cool enzyme, one of my favorites, knock it down dramatically. It doesn't have a thing to do with the formation of tubes. You knock the MT1-MMP, they're markedly blocked, as I've mentioned. Okay, so one of the questions that's sort of fun, this is a movie that Brian Saunders made again. We've actually give a population of cells with their nucleus labeled with GFP, and this is on a monolayer. This is just cells moving around on a 2D substrate. And they're moving all over the place. And so it's kind of neat because, you can sort of, at least, it's kind of nice in our case in terms of imaging this, and is that there's just a division right there. But it's fun because this allows you to, if they were all labeled, it gets almost too jumbled. It's hard to manage. So it turns out that, actually, we didn't do this on purpose. It just ended up nice that way. So anyway, this is just control migration. So if you add GM601, which is the thing that I just told you, blocks or TIMP2 or 3 or 4, which totally blocks morphogenesis, what happens? Well, they're on a 2D substrate and they're having it to do a thing. These enzymes don't block, and these enzymes probably play no role whatsoever in the ability of these cells to move around a two-dimensional substrate. So I think that's pretty cool. So there are others in the literature who claim that, at least in some cell types, that these have effects. In our system, they absolutely do nothing. And I mean, they have no effect. So, okay, so now in contrast, same cells, here they are making lumens. And so what's neat, as you'll see, as they start forming lumens in these overlays, you can see clearly that they're moving around. Once the spaces are created, they can move around within those spaces very nicely. Okay, so very nice. So here's the next cell, and this is the GM601. It's unfortunately a little pixelated here, but you can see the nucleus, and you can see the cells are sending out processes, and really they're not moving. So importantly, although they're sending processes, the cell bodies are really not moving. Okay, so what we think is if you then look at that and do tracings over time, you can clearly see that they kind of spin around for a while. And then once they do their thing, then they, interesting, many of them have this sort of linear phase where they, I assume that's because the tubes begins to form and then they can shoot quickly in the space. In contrast, when they have GM601, they're not able to move. Or this is also true of TIMP2, 3, 4 treated cells, MT1, MMP knockdown cells, same thing. So we think that MT1, MMP is, again, the molecule that is doing this phenomenon. Yeah.
Have you tried this in low density?
0.5
or 1?
No, that's a good question, but I mean, this is optimized for morphogenesis, and so I'm trying to focus on that. And then, so if you quantitate that, you can clearly see in 2D migration, these temps, inhibitors do nothing. In 3D, they clearly do that. So the flip side of this is if MT1 MMP is an important molecule in making a lumen, what happens if you overexpress that enzyme? So Brian Saunders created an adenovirus that overexpresses this. This is actually an enzyme that's difficult to detect in normal endothelial cells. I think it's because it's so active. If you overexpress that, actually what's really neat, and I don't have the slide, but these actually are about 3 times the diameter of the controls. And so it actually really does increase luminal diameters. So MTMMP, I think we've shown in both directions, if we knock it down, they can't make a lumen. If we overexpress it, they make big lumens. And if there's another thing I didn't mention, is if you create a mutant of MT1MMP that has a E to A mutant, it's just catalytically dead, this particular mutant is unable to do this. So you have to have, not that that's surprising, you have to have a functional enzyme. But secondly, lastly, it's been a question whether the E to A mutant might actually be a dominant negative inhibitor, and it is not in our system. Okay, so the last point on this is that I actually think this is kind of a new assay we're playing around with and having fun with. Charlie mentioned that we were discussing Swiss cheese. Well, here's my Swiss cheese kind of look. FITC collagen, there is some aggregated gunk in here. But you can see these physical holes. So as these cells are making lumens, they're creating these physical holes. And we think, literally, this is an enzyme, and they're expanding, and the enzyme's creating them. Yeah?
So I know that there are 3 demonstrated ways or described ways of one, a single cell to make lumen, and one of them is for the cell send out processes and connect to itself on the other side.
I don't think that's what goes on.
You don't see that in the system.
No.
You only see the vacuole lumen formation.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, I don't. So anyway, but the important point is that you start vacuolating, you more in these pinosomes, but then the protease is involved in expanding it, and then it creates these holes and these spaces, and these are green, red ECs that sort of, it's not a perfect correspondence because they leave in some cases. They move. They create the space and take off. So one of the things we're doing, I don't have to show you, we've done it, is to make movies of this. So you start off with a homogeneous gel, and as they develop, they create these structures, and actually it leads to things you can do quantitatively. So, overall, I'd say that in terms of our morphogenic stuff, the multiple molecules we've identified now, key integrins, RhoGTPases, and a protease are required. We think they create these spaces. We think it's a proteolytic event. And what we really want to learn in the lab is how all this coordinates coordinately regulates and hooks up to form this. So there's got to be coordinate signaling between these molecules. And then I'll just finish real briefly, just briefly mention again the concept that as these things form, they create a genetic program, they develop a program which drives, they create induce molecules that drive formation, but we also think they induce molecules that drive their own regression. Or they could. That could, if the given conditions were established. And so two molecules that we think are really important here are MMP1 and MMP10. I really don't have time to go into a lot of detail. But this, I just want to make an analogy with the neural development here. And that is, and that's something I, a couple years ago, published and called it the endothelial cell target hypothesis. And that is that, like neurons, I think endothelial cells are looking for a target. And that they create a network, but they want to recruit something to be a target. And the cell type that they often do is recruit a pericyte. And we think that that probably is really needed. And a lot of data in the literature from Cachette and many other people has shown that these vessels that have pericytes are much more stable. And so if they, you know, so what I'm saying is that endothelial cells, as they form a network, are intrinsically unstable unless something is there to help turn and quiesce them. And there's a lot of complexity, a lot of interesting steps that are probably involved in this. And so this kind of sets up this idea of things like MMP1. MMP1 is dramatically induced in our system. It's a serum-free model. It's a pro, the proenzyme is made. They have a ton of this stuff. They make it. It's just sitting in the media, and nothing happens. But if you, so you can block, if you knock this down with siRNA, morphogenesis is fine. If you block it with antibodies, TIMP1, alpha-2, macroglobulin, all these things are well known to block this protein, nothing happens. Now, the thing about this, though, is that the enzyme you're seeing there is the proenzyme. I mean, they're not even activating the enzyme. They're making huge amounts of it, and it's just sitting there in a latent state. So my question a long years ago was, well, why are they doing this? Well, you know, I think it's really cool why they're doing it. If it turns out if you add something that activates this enzyme, instead of getting more formation and more tubes, actually what you get is regression. The tube networks that are there, you know, you can do this. What's really neat about the system is you can do this different ways. In this case, I've added it from the beginning. So no PLG, you get that same curve. With PLG, you start seeing these lower activated forms. And this is a kind of a readout of the assay. The actual entire collagen gel contracts into that little nubbin there. And that's the endothelial cells destroying the matrix and contracting the gel that's remaining. And, you know, this is just a demonstration of how incredibly powerful they are in being able to degrade collagen. So here are some alpha-1, alpha-2 chains, Kumasi blue stains of monomers, dimers, trimers in our system. Over time, you can see that they look stable if you don't add any plasminogen. If you add plasminogen, now what I've done here is I allowed cultures to form for 48 hours. And then I added PLG, and literally 12 to 16 hours later, that entire collagen is gone. And you can see the characteristic three-quarter cuts, which are the classic collagenase cuts that occur, and then it gets destroyed, and these cells literally collapse and fall apart. So we think endothelial cells have incredible capacity to destroy their matrix. But in order to form, you've got to protect your matrix in a way. So I think this is like a way of, so like MT1 MMP is localized proteolysis, and that's what they form the lumens, we think. But this is sort of an overall scaffold destruction and mechanism, theoretically, yeah.
So is that if it recruits the parasites, if that's the target, then it recruits parasites, won't parasites express proteins that build the vessel?
Yes, and okay, so I just wanted to show you, one of these quick assays, and it's just a movie real quick to show the kind of thing that happens when they, so they're perfectly fine. You add a little PLG in 16 hours, the whole thing just boom, okay? So the thing that's cool is what getting at your question. So what happens if you add pericytes? So that's what we've done. So you add pericytes to these tube networks, and as you increase the percentage of pericytes relative to endothelial cells, and get to 20 to 30%, meaning 20%, 30% pericytes relative to endothelial cells, at that point, they no longer regress. And the proteinases, they're blocked. And so if you then look at, and what's cool is if you start looking at these co-cultures and doing EM, you can really see how they're hooking up with the endothelial cell, and you can even start to imagine maybe there's some basement membrane matrix forming between them. But I don't really have time to talk about this in detail, but what happens is when you add the pericytes, they no longer activate the MMPs, 1 and 10. And interestingly, curiously, I think this is really cool, they actually shut down the production of MMP1 to some extent by the endothelial cells. The mechanism, we have no idea, but a very exciting issue. And then lastly, I'll just say that we think we know which tissue inhibitor of metalloproteases are involved here. We have good, very good data, Brian Saunders in the lab again. Endothelial cells make TIMP2, large amounts of it. These are constant endothelial cells, increasing amounts of pericytes. As you do that, TIMP3 goes way up. And we believe that that is dependent on endothelial cells. Pericytes can make TIMP3, but really, well, in three dimensions, only make it in the presence of endothelial cells. And so we think that there's some key interaction. And this molecule, as I've already demonstrated to you, completely blocks morphogenesis. At the same time, TIMP3 blocks regression, too. So we think that actually the interaction between the two cells drives the production of TIMP3. I don't have time to present the, this is our model. But what we've shown, actually, that now by siRNA, is that if you knock down TIMP2 from endothelial cells or TIMP3 from pericytes, that destabilizes the system. So we think it's some sort of combination between T2 and T3. And both of these, very interestingly in the literature, I mean, these can block the enzyme that drives formation, and it can block the enzymes that drive regression, like MMP110 or MT1MMP. Same with TIMP3. TIMP3 is unique, though, in that it can block this class of enzymes called ADAMs. These are very important because these can shed growth factors. Growth factors activate the system. You know, anytime you have growth factors being liberated everywhere. So if TIMP3 is around, this thing gets shut down and it's a quiescent signal. So we think that in order to stabilize it too, a pericyte would have to both inhibit invasion and morphogenesis and at the same time inhibit regression. So we think endothelial cell networks, you know, are programmed to form networks. They do this, but they're also set up to regress. And we think pericytes are the target. They come in, they're recruited, and they have to, in order to stabilize eventually, you have to inhibit both the process that was going on, which is formation, and you have to block regression simultaneously. And we think TIMP2 and TIMP3 are very attractive molecules that may be key in controlling this interaction. So a lot of the work today was done by a remarkable postdoc, Brian Saunders, with a good team of people, a technician, Jennifer Faske, Juan Chilco, a very good graduate student, and Kevin Fisher did the tumor invasion, and I've had a very productive collaboration with Brandt's lab at the NIH on the vacuoles story.